This is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Long, extra long intro for cars to pass. Once upon a time, this river ran all by himself, no cars passing. Now we got a power plant. Sit right behind us. So this song right here is dedicated to doing it better this time. I ain't here to make a big old show. I ain't here to make the popular vote. I just want you to know that I see you, I see you. I see the leftovers of you. Feel you linger in my room. Pick the frame but look the residue. I just want you to know that I see you, I see you. I feel the leftovers of you. If this was 1893, I bet you wouldn't be tipping your hat to me. I'm here to do it better, make it better this time. I'm here to do it better, make it better this time. You know we gotta make it right. I feel you looking over my backside, on my shoulders, breathing down my spine. But it didn't mean no. Granddaughter, granddaughter, oh, you better get yourself to some water. Put your foot in and kick up your skirt. And put your toes in. You got to be heard. You got to be heard. You got to be heard. Oh, yeah. You got to be heard. You got to be heard. Oh, got to be heard. You got to be heard. Ooh, oh, yeah. Don't you get caught in the belly of the canyon. Don't you get caught in the belly of the canyon this time. Long skirt don't hurt. Secret sacred on the mountainside. Constellations, no, 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 no. Helps me to remember this time. I bet you wouldn't be tipping your hat to me. I'm here to do it better, make it better this time. I'm here to do it better, make it better this time. Yeah, yeah, we do it better this time. Am I doing the right thing? Making the wrong turn? I know there's more. Like I've been here before. I walked on this land before. I've been walking this land. I've been walking this land before. Sit down, sit down. Don't you get to the water side. Don't you be too hard, nah, nah. Get yourself to the water side. Don't you be too hard, nah, nah. Get yourself to the water side. Don't you be too hard, nah, nah. Granddaughter, granddaughter. Granddaughter, granddaughter.
eat the safamimakaka. Granada. Dun 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 dun.
All right, that was Jesse Naomi with Jesse Naomi Creatives, as recorded by Imagining Community on the North Fork of the Feather River in Belden, California, for the April 24th edition of Studio Number 416, right here on KZFR 90.1 FM. We also recorded a Run for Salmon mini lesson promo that day. We did a lot that day. Jesse, I hope you're listening. That was such a beautiful thing. Never forget the memories from the wonderful time we had up there on the North Fork with Brian. Brian catching more fish than he's ever caught in his life. Yeah. But you can find the Run for Salmon mini lessons on Imagining Community's YouTube page. And, you know, late breaking news flash. Jesse Naomi with Desiree Harp and Lila June will be performing on a live streamed Run for Salmon fundraiser May 15. Check them out on their webpage, man. Run in the number 4 and Salmon. I think this might be the first time since the pandemic all the voiceovers are live. So I guess when it's playing, if you want to call it, you could talk to me, because usually I just pre-produce the whole show. But we're rolling with some really cool stuff today. I have to say, blown away with our lead segment. And we're going to start with Gus Hain, who's with Save Auburn Ravine Salmon and Steelhead. And he's put together a restoration site on this tree farm he has in Auburn. It's like 7 or 8 acres. It's like something out of like Disneyland. And he's going to be willing that to the local tribe there in Placer County. And he's a perfect lead-in for our series here on Water and Fire tonight on People Powered Radio. Here we are with Gus Hain, yep, here at his tree farm. And thank you for having us on Pine Valley Ranch. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, tell us just a little bit about yourself, Bob. And I'm really interested in this Butte salmon story.
I'll start right into it. Basically, it makes a person aware of what these fish are doing. And so there's one tree within about a mile stretch of Butte Creek, and all the fish are thermaling. They're in the shade of that one tree. And if you first look at this photograph, it just looks like it's shade on the water, but it's not. It's just full of fish, about maybe 1,000 fish. And so I asked the gentleman that took that picture, I said, what do those fish do during the day as the sun moves across the sky? Mm-hmm. And he said, they go downstream about 2 miles. There's another tree on the west side of the creek, and they huddle up there until tomorrow, and then in the morning they'll come back up to this one. So that's what these fish are doing until they're waiting to spawn, okay? And so that's just one of the things that I noticed on Butte Creek.
So maybe give our listeners an understanding of where on Butte Creek, you know, geography-wise, where are you talking about, Bob, and what are the years? What are the years?
Well, first of all, I don't think I'd like to tell anybody where this is at, because okay, what happens there is you're going to have people come and mm-hmm. poach salmon because mm-hmm. they're in there for longer periods.
It was
of
on
time.
The creek, Butte Creek?
Butte
Somewhere
Creek.
On Butte Creek.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
What
so,
was the years, Bob?
It happens every year. And so what I'm trying to get to is, we were talking just earlier about planting trees, and that's one of the things mm-hmm. that I've done since I started with Sarsis and before. And so shading the creek is important, but so this emphasizes the fact that these fish thermal. And a lot of people don't know what that means, but they like to get under a rock. If you've ever fished for trout during the middle of the day, you don't see a one, right? Mm-hmm. Early morning, late in the evening, they come out to start feeding, and that's what they do. That's their habit, and that's the way that they do. And salmon are the same, because they come from deep water and cold water. And so not only do we need oxygenated water, but we need shade. We need shade on our creeks, so we have to have planting programs. And in this particular case, they're not necessarily planting non-deciduous trees, because out of a non-deciduous trees like these redwoods around us here that you can see, Douglas fir, whatever, they produce oxygen year-round. And as we know, we need about 1 billion more trees back on the planet. And, you know, that's just an estimate. It could be 1 trillion trees we need back. But point is, every environment has to be friendly to whatever it is that you're building it to.
Right.
And if you don't build it to that fish or that whatever, if it's a bear, whatever you're trying to build, it has to make him come to that area.
So what's changed, though, Bob? Before I hit the mic and started recording, you were talking about how, you know, it's been many years. You used to live up in Chico. But what's changed in the salmon runs since you lived up there, and whatever year time frame that was, and how does it differ from what it looks like today?
Well, I would have to say that probably the biggest problem is the fact that lack of water, because there's too many people consuming that groundwater. Groundwater in a creek will go to the lowest point, right? And so gravity pulls it down. And as humans use up that groundwater, you're going to take more surface water. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's the biggest problem for fish. Even though it might look like there's adequate water there, if you drive over Butte Creek today, I was just over it about 3 weeks ago, and it looked nice. But it's probably not what it used to be when I was a child. I was born there in 1945, okay, mm-hmm. and lived in that area for about 8 years. And it seemed to me like there was more water. So there was less people using it. There was less people probably taking water out for rice growing, wheat growing, whatever. A lot of almonds in that area. And so all those things strain the economy of the fish. And I call it an economy because that's part of their life, and they have a right to live too. And so if you take all that away from them, they go. And if you just take some of the reports that Fish and Game put out in the 1960s, we've gone from thousands of fish to teens coming back. And so there's a problem. And not only that, if you read any NOAA reports, you can find out that the Pacific Ocean, we have 350,000 sea lions. According to NOAA, they need 12 fish a day. They like salmon, steelhead. So multiply that, 350,000 times 12 a day. And so that's another thing. So maybe we need to take sea lions off the Endangered Species Act. So we have a gamut of things that need to be corrected. And like I said, with Placer County coming up with the PCC plan, a gentleman by the name of Greg McKenzie has been working 12 years to appease everybody within all the different branches that we deal with. And so if we can simplify this, maybe we can make a return of a lot of different things. You
PCC plan, that is...
Placer County Conservation Plan is what that stands for. And I've been waiting for it, like I said, for 12 years since I'd gone to a few meetings, talked to a few people about it. To date, it's been passed by the Board of Supervisors. Now, Fish and Game and all the other agencies that are going to be losing a little control, I'll call it control because that's what they normally do. They have control over those things, over the waterways. And so I think it's going to be a very positive thing once it's completed, Bill. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, once again, that was Gus Hain with Save Auburn Ravine Salmon and Steelhead. Our next segment coming up was recorded last week with Zeke Lunder on location overlooking Butte Creek in Helltown at the home of Alan Hawthorne with Friends of Butte Creek Canyon. Here's Zeke's bio from DeerCreekGIS.com. Most of it, we had a little technical difficulty, so some of it I'm winging. But Zeke and his wife started the Deer Creek GIS back in 2011. And Zeke handed over leadership of DCR to Firestorm Wildlands Fire Suppression in 2017. And Zeke and his wife's no longer involved in day-to-day operations of the company. But he works with them to help lead prescribed fire training exchanges with the Fire Learning Network's TREX. Check that out, TREX, T-R-E-X program. Builds equipment for our model mapping division and provides wildfire management and prescribed fire consulting for public agencies and private landowners. He's been working as a geographer on wildfire and forestry projects since 1995 and has been certified as a wildland fire manager by the Association for Fire Ecology. Water Maven Jim Brobeck says Zeke is one of his favorite human beings. Boom. Here we are with Gus Hain, here at his tree farm. And thank you for having us on Pine Valley Ranch. Did I get that right?
Absolutely.
So Alan Hawthorne, this is his place, and he's done a ton of work to help people learn about the fish that are in here. So he built this spot so we could bring people like you to come meet the fish. Yeah, there they are.
Oh, wow. It's beautiful.
Look up around the corner. See that darkness going all the way up to the whitewater?
Those are all fish?
Yeah.
That's hundreds of fish.
Hundreds of Chinook salmon came up from the ocean.
Now, what makes the environment so favorable as far as the water that allows them to get all the way up here? Because as I understand it, I've heard that this is one of the most viable salmon runs left in the state year in, year out.
Well, there's been a huge amount of money spent to make it happen. You know, back in the 90s. So Butte Creek is really this kind of labyrinth, right? Like, starts off simple enough up by Butte Meadows and right. comes down here, Forks of Butte, and it comes down through Helltown and Durham. But once you get past Durham, it goes into these rice fields. And in the past, they just had these dams, and they just divert the creek straight out into the rice field. And there were some fish ladders, but, like, things weren't in set up in the fish's favor. And then it just keeps getting more and more complicated as you get farther and farther down into the valley. Butte Creek, it splits off, and, like, it doesn't hit the Sac River until all the way down by the Sac Airport. And along the way, it goes through irrigation canals. So the fish used to really have to work a lot harder to get here. So people like the L.A. Metropolitan Water District, in the late 90s, there was talk of listing the Butte Creek salmon as an endangered species. And none of the big commercial interests wanted, no one wanted that to happen. When that happens, it's not good for anyone. So L.A., MWD, water users, and all these agencies spent probably hundreds of millions of dollars on fish passage improvement projects. So we built a ton of huge fish ladders in the valley. We rebuilt a ton of dams. We put in screens on the pumps. Because people would just pump water straight out of the creek and it would suck up baby fish and grind them up and throw them out in the fields. So that made a big difference. Before that happened in the 90s, there were years where there was, you know, 20 fish in the whole river, something like that. So now this year we've got something like 20,000. So it's a huge amount of work by a lot of people, and a lot of people work together to make that happen.
Who are some of those people?
Well, the Pacific Coast Association of Fishermen's Associations. You know, the coastal fishermen got really involved. They threw lobbying power behind making it happen. The farmers got behind it, the state and federal agencies. And it brought a lot of people together. I feel like fish and fire are one thing they have in common is that they're two issues that bring people together across political divides. It's like you can sit down and talk with anyone about fish and talk with anyone about fire. And it's one thing that makes me hopeful about fire and fish is just that people tend to come together around those things, regardless of their political bent.
So what we're looking at here, right here, is will these fish be hanging out here for some period of time before they go upstream? What's the lay of the land here?
Yeah, so these are Butte Creek Chinook, and they're the spring run. So the way I understand it is the reason that these fish are spring run is because in the past, before we had all the kind of modern water plumbing and manglement of the valley, Butte Creek didn't actually connect to the Sacramento River in the summertime. It would only really be flowing into the Sac in the spring and in the winter. So the fish couldn't come up in the summer. Like most places, the fish start coming up in summer, early fall. They couldn't do that on this creek because the creek wouldn't actually connect to the river. So they adapted to come up in the spring, and then they hang out up here kind of from the covered bridge on up in these deep, nice, shady pools. And then they'll spawn in the fall, because if they spawn right now, the water will be too warm, and they need kind of high floodwaters to stir up the gravel where their nests are. So they make their reds here in the fall, and it's timed about right so the fish are hatching out and viable right around the time that the first big winter flows come and wash them all downstream.
How much further upstream will they go to hatch?
They'll go about another 5 or 6 miles.
Yeah. How close do they get to the headwaters?
There's a dam here that's 5 miles above us. That's the Centerville Head Dam.
Okay.
But then above the Centerville Head Dam, there's natural waterfalls and other things that block them. So effectively, there's natural barriers, you know, 5 or 6 okay. miles upstream. It's California, right? So everything's complicated. One thing about this water is that a lot of this water is actually coming from the Feather River. So Butte Creek, like most places in California, the water rights were assigned during the gold rush. And a lot of the water rights were already bought up by miners by the time that we wanted to do agriculture in the valley. And then there was also hydropower, and they decided to bring water over from the Feather River to use, I don't know if it's for mining or ag, but because of that, the powerhouses upstream of here actually get their water from the west branch of the Feather River, and they're legally required to keep a certain amount of water in the creek, because if they don't, the water can get too warm and the fish die. So managing this watershed for the fish involves dealing with, well, farmers want their water at a certain time of the year. PG&E wants water for hydropower at a different time of the year. There's a lot of juggling, and California's just like that. You just have water that comes out of one creek, goes on the canal around to a different creek, dumps in there, gets taken out downstream.
And they're diverting water from the Feather River here to Butte Creek?
Yeah.
Where does that diversion happen?
Below Philbrook Reservoir by Sterling City. And it comes through a tunnel if you ever go on the flumes above Paradise, one of those flumes comes from Feather River, one comes from Butte Creek. And then the water rights on this creek, actually, a lot of that Feather River water goes and waters the M&T Ranch out by the mouth of Big Chico Creek. So there's just a lot of players when you start talking about, like, hey, we need more water in here at a certain time of year. There's a lot of different competing factions and players. So people like Alan Hartthorne and Friends of Butte Creek, they've really been dogged in pushing PG&E and saying, hey, the water, they're coming out here and checking water temperature, saying, hey, the water's too warm, fish are dying, pushing for changes in how the water's managed.
How would you describe what we're looking at, the vista of the hills and the riparia? Because it's gorgeous.
Yeah, this is Helltown, and it's just like Upper Park, but deeper and more canyony, right? So we got these mud flows that make the cliffs like you see on the north rim of Chico Creek. There's more trees here than we have over in Upper Park. It's kind of like Upper Park up above Salmon Hole, where it starts to be more brushy and a little deeper and more kind of confined canyon. And the creek is a lot wider here than Chico Creek. We're looking down at this pool, and it's got a couple hundred ginormous salmon. Some of them are pretty beat up already. They have this fungus on their noses, big white patches. And then we're looking at this landscape that is burned twice in the last 20 years, and there's gray pine on it and a lot of low kind of oak scrub and brush, and it's kind of deserty. Like we were saying earlier, this is a fire landscape. Everything about this landscape is designed to burn. And usually what happens around here is the fire will start when a lightning strike hits on the top of the ridge over there. And then fires just don't race downhill very often. So one thing it's important, I think, to say about fire is that, especially in Northern California, we've got what we call a fire regime. Fire regime is kind of a way of summing up, like, when fires happen, how often they happen, what their effects are. It's just kind of the story of how fire burns in a place. We've always had lightning here, and every 10 or 20 years we get a big lightning storm that starts lots of fires. And then when that happens, it gets smoky and everyone kind of feels like it's Armageddon. But usually what happens is, if you look at the weather patterns on the West Coast and in California, in summer times we have this kind of chunk of high pressure air that sits over the West Coast for weeks at a time, and that's why it's so hot, that's why it's so still, and why the air in the valley gets so crappy. Is high pressure just kind of is like if you have a lid on a pot of water, it just kind of simmers there, and if you take the lid off, then all that steam boils out and steams up your kitchen. Or if you say you have a barbecue or a little fire pit and you put a cover on there that's just a lid, the fire goes out. You put the lid on your hibachi and it just kind of simmers there, right? So high pressure is like that lid on your barbecue, and it keeps the smoke in, and it's real still for weeks at a time here. So then you have a storm comes through, or just some sort of frontal passage, and the lid comes off the pot and the smoke lifts out and fires kind of kick ass for a couple days. But our normal pattern here is if we do get a big lightning storm, it's followed by a week or two of high pressure, and all that smoke just packs in, and the fires often are started on top of the hill, and they just kind of back slowly down the mountain during that time. Meanwhile, the media is saying, oh my God, it's a disaster, it's 1,000 fires, it's devastating, thousands of acres. If you look at the 2020 lightning bust that we had, the vast majority of the acreage that burned in that initial month after the lightning storm up until September, it was what we call good fire. It's backing fire generally. It's just creeping along. It's almost like what we try to do with a prescribed burn. There's places up here in Upper Butte Creek that burned last year under those conditions. It moved through thickets of pine forest and didn't even kill any of the trees. There's good things that are happening. When we have a big lightning blast and everything gets smoky and we've got lots of fires burning, there's good things happening. But then what happens usually is if those fires are still burning in September, then our big winds come, and we saw what happened with the Bear Fire. That good fire makes a big run, and then we don't think it's such a good fire anymore. But that's just part of our ecology here, is that we're going to have frequent, maybe once a decade, maybe more, mass ignition events that start hundreds or thousands of fires. And then our normal tools for putting fires out, like air tankers, helicopters, one, we're totally overwhelmed because we don't have enough firefighters and never will have enough firefighters to deal with 1,000 ignitions on the same day. And two, we just can't use our techie tools and our big air tankers. So the fires keep getting larger. That's just reality. That's not ever going to change. We're never going to have enough air tankers to solve that problem because it's smoky. We can't use air tankers at all.
So we can't really fight our way out of that. We need to address that that's reality. We can cut a lot of brush around our town, things that we don't want to burn up, our radio towers, and that'll help when there's these big fires. But the more we put out fires, the worse the fuels get. So here we are in Helltown, and it hasn't burned for 100 years. But that's not a good thing. Like, that doesn't do anything. Every time we put out a fire here, under conditions that would maybe be beneficial, it just makes things worse and worse. And eventually there's going to be a fire here with those north winds, and it's going to burn everything here, and it'll probably kill people, and then it'll be a real human disaster. So to me, it's really painful to just to know that's going to happen. You know, we knew that was going to happen with Paradise. We knew that was going to happen with Berry Creek. We knew the scenarios. You know, we knew that 20 years ago. And then to watch people rebuild in Paradise with kind of lip service to mitigation, and not addressing that reality that, no, we can't put out all the fires. It's not possible. And no, we can't cut all the brush. The scale of the problem. It's hard to sit with that and watch it happen over and over and get worse each time.
Reminds me of a proverb. I won't get exactly right. Only fire can control or contain fire.
Right.
What would you add to that?
Well, if fire does what it wants to do, right? And we kind of can steer it a little bit. But yeah, it's our primary tool as firefighters is using fire. And we need to be better at using it. You know, this thing with prescribed burning, right now people are talking about they really want to scale up prescribed burning. And we have these really narrow windows of time to get it done in what people consider to be a safe way. We have these really narrow windows of time in which the agencies let us use fire. And that's for a good reason in a lot of places. You know, like we used to, as climate has changed and we have later and later dry, rainless falls. You know, when I first started my career 20 years ago, it was really rare for me to go out on a large fire after the second week of September. It only happened a couple of times in the first decade of my career. And now we have, you know, every year we've got a campfire or a bear fire or a wine country fire or another wine country fire. And so that's really cut into what used to be our prime burning season. The other thing about trying to get burning done in the fall is that our firefighters are working so hard now, 1,000 hours of overtime by the end of September, that one, they don't want to go out and burn in October, November, and two, they have vacation, annual leave, they need to burn, and they haven't seen their family for 5 or 6 months. So, you know, relying on the firefighter workforce to get burning done is problematic. And it's a reason that we need to build community capacity outside the government to burn. You know, part of this conversation about taking back fire, like, since when did the government come to own the use of fire? You know, the fire, you know, legally in California, if you own property, you can burn it. Unfortunately, we end up with burn bans that are kind of blanket statewide because there's fires in Southern California. You can't burn in Northern California. But if we're really going to make change and use prescribed fire at a scale, we have to be willing to use prescribed fire in June and July and even August, because we know that there are times that that is doable. And we know that we can control fire in July and August. Like, we do it all the time. But there's this real aversion to in-season burning. We're not going to ever make a dent in it if we try to burn, like, okay, you can burn after you've had 2 inches of rain in the fall, but you can't burn if you have a north wind. And it's like, well, after you've had 2 inches of rain in the fall, you can't burn until you get a north wind to dry out the fuels. So we've created these really narrow windows in which the bureaucracies feel comfortable letting people use fire. And there are good reasons for that. No one wants to start the next campfire. But it's become unnecessarily burdensome on people who have safe conditions, have the resources ready, and are still denied permission to burn.
Can you give our listeners a little bit of background on your 20-plus years working with fire here in Buchanan?
Well, I came into fire through the Forest Service. I worked on a timber marking crew, and our job was to mark trees for thinning in the forest for fire safety up around Eagle Lake in Lassen County. What we kind of learned there was that we should walk through the woods with paint and kind of pretend that we were fire, and we should mark the trees that a fire would kill, because the idea was using logging to mimic fire. So I like to walk around and think, like, okay, if I was a fire, I would torch up this tree and I'd kill that one. And so we just kind of went around and played fire with paint guns, right? And we paint a yellow stripe on the tree, and then they'd come and they'd cut it out. So got me thinking about just how fire works, and we did some firefighting in that job. And then I got a job at Chico State, and the job was to look at fire hazards in Butte Creek and Chico Creek watersheds, and ended up doing some mapping through that and got a job when we had some big fires here in 99 that burned the other side of List Canyon. That was the first fire mapping assignment I had. And then right after that in 2000, I got hired as a contractor
and worked the last 20 years in fire mapping. So we go out during fires and map where the fire is, and firefighters use that to plan their attack. So just I've been observing most of the big fires in California over the last 20 years and learning about how to burn. You know, as a contractor, I've been burning through most of those 20 years. And the last 10 years or so, I've been helping do burning up in the Klamath River with some nonprofits and tribes up there. And they've really built a culture up there of, you know, we've got school field trips coming out and, you know, six-year-olds walking out to the fire line and watching us burn. And that's been inspiring and made me want to try to bring that work out here to Butte County. You know, how can we make that part of our healing? You know, we're also scarred and terrified of fire here. And every time the wind blows, you get on Facebook and people are hysterical, you know, and it's crippling us. Yeah. But I feel like it's really crippling us. It's stopping us from moving forward, and it's stopping us from really recognizing that reality that fire is the only tool we have to get ourselves in better relation with it.
I remember you were mentioning, you know, one of the benefits of you know, low water in the spring is you can have prescribed burns. But as kind of a corollary, I've seen a lot of Facebook posts recently, Zeke, that are like, there's a prescribed burn going on here in Yankee Hill. Don't worry about it. You've right. got people like out there trying to tap down that hysteria and that trauma, yeah. you know, of seeing smoke in the air.
Yeah, and it's real. You know, like, I understand yeah. if you're in the valley and you look up in the foothills and you see a plume of smoke, like, it's right. real trauma, you know? I had some friends that were doing a prescribed burn up by Philbrick Reservoir a couple years ago, and they were, you know, they were pushing the envelope. It was windy. They have a real commitment to healthier forests and seizing the windows that we have. But I was driving back from Orland, and I could see this big column from their prescribed burn, and I was really worried because I had that gut feeling that everyone else has when you look up and see the smoke.
Yeah.
But I think what people need to know about the prescribed fire that we're doing is that these people dressed in yellow who have been out for the last 20 years dealing with the worst fires, the people that you think are the heroes and trust to save you and keep you safe, and the people you put the signs up for, they're the same people that are out there doing these prescribed fires. And there's this kind of real cynicism about the ability of the government to get anything right. You know, oh, if the Forest Service is doing it, they're going to lose it for sure. And I want people to have more trust in us. You know, you love us when we're putting the fire out, mm-hmm. but we need you to give us your love when we're lighting the fire. And you need to support us. Some of these fires aren't going to stay in the box. It's the nature of weather. And none of us want to start the next big fire, but there's no doing this without risk. You know, it's not that the fire jumps the line when it's on day one, when it's pushing hard up the hill. It's that a stump is burning a week later and there's a windstorm and a chunk of burning stump rolls downhill into the green. And then you've got a fire. But I think people need to recognize that a lot of us who are doing this work are taking enormous risk. And we're doing it on the behalf of the people that are going to benefit from safer communities. Mm-hmm. And we're going to need your support. We don't need the media every time there's a burn pile that turns into an acre. To say, oh, an escape prescribed fire destroyed an acre of Magalia. It's like, well, one, did it destroy anything? And two, was it a real problem? And three, is the fact that someone left their burn pile that might have been illegal in the first place and went to town and they got away, does that really have anything to do with a professional organization that's out there with all the right equipment doing it in a professional manner?
Imagine communities made possible. Generous contributions, keys of our supporters, and by Friends of the Arts. Your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Dahlmeier Insurance Agency, an independent agent and retail broker since 1948. Dahlmeier Insurance provides a range of coverage options from home and auto insurance to farm and ranch coverage. You can reach Dahlmeier Insurance in Chico at 342-6421 and in Oroville at 533-3424. Shout out to Zeke Lunder for that last segment. I think I had probably 40 minutes of really good stuff from Zeke, you know, and I thought that was the best edit that I had for the 20-minute slot. But stay tuned next week. I'm putting together an Imagining Community stringer for the Chico News and Review that's going to delve into the health of the Salmon Run and here in Butte County, and how we can kind of help parlay that a little bit to some of the other areas that aren't doing so well. And I'm really pleased. We're going to be doing the second episode right now of the North State Water Report. And I'm gonna front load this with Hidden Water, another Imagine Community produced audio segment up in Sycamore Channel in the end of February with Jim Brobeck here on People Powered Radio.
The water on the ground, hidden water, the water on the ground holds our streams, the water on the ground holds our creek up. The water on the ground keeps our shade trees green in the hot summertime. The water on the ground fills our house pipes. The water on the ground means everything. Oh, yeah, don't let them sell our underground water out of here. The water on the ground, hidden water. The water on the ground. It grows our mighty orchards. The water on the ground brews our local beer. Oh, yeah. The water on the ground wets our summer gardens. The water on the ground is very dear. Oh, yeah. Don't let them sell our underground water out of here. Oh. Keeps our creeks cool. The water on the ground sustains oak trees. The water on the ground is needed by the salmon. 'Cause water on the ground bring connectivity. Creek to river, river to delta, delta to bay, bay to sea, sea to delta, delta to river, river to stream, and whoa, the water on the ground, hidden water, the water on the ground holds our streams.
We're here today for another installment of our monthly North State Water Report. My name is Ron Topi, and I'm with Jim Brobeck.
I'm a water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance.
And this month, we're going to talk about groundwater. And in last month's report, we talked about how groundwater has always been a buffer between drought years and high water years for the hydrological cycle of the valley. And I'm going to ask Jim to explain that and how current water policy affects our groundwater.
Back before human beings started punching holes in the ground to suck water out of the ground, the aquifer system in the Great Central Valley was a very complex, multi-layered system. It had a deep layer that was pressurized because it was replenished from up in the hills. And it went underneath layers of confining aquifers, of confining layers that allowed the pressure to build up down deep. Here in the Sacramento Valley, on the Tuscan Aquifer, the freshwater base in the middle of the valley is down there probably 12 to 1,300 feet. And it's under such pressure, it was under such pressure that it, as it leaked up through the confining layers, through cracks and seams, there were even springs in the middle of the valley that were being provided base flow from the deepest portion of the aquifer. But once the deep wells started puncturing that and taking water out of the deep aquifer, the pressure has declined. So now it's still pressurized, but it doesn't come all the way to the surface anymore. So back before the so-called development of the aquifer, when we would get extended periods of drought that paleoclimatologists have identified, that lasted up to 150 years in California. And yet the Central Valley remained an ecologically robust environment. Valley oak trees could continue to thrive and provide acorns for the animals and for the people. And the stream flow and river flow could keep going even with just a trickle of precipitation because the groundwater continued to provide a base flow. It provided an ecological buffer. But in modern times, with the development of groundwater with wells, it's being considered more of an economic buffer against drought. So the water purveyors and the water policy experts in Sacramento look to groundwater as a water supply, primarily for agriculture, during these dry years. And it's called conjunctive use when water diverters, people that have senior water rights to take water out of the river, can switch to groundwater during dry years to allow the river to continue to flow through the delta and keep the delta fresh enough to pump out of the delta to water suppliers south of the delta. And so some of the districts in Northern California will then turn to groundwater in order to water their crops, water their rice fields. So it's providing the economic buffer during this dry year. I've got great concern that they're looking at 1 or 2 years, maybe 3 years of consecutive drought. And then what happens if that drought continues for 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, with only periodic wet years, but mostly dry years? And it looks like we're entering that sort of climate regime right now. So we're entering a period perhaps of mega drought that is going to be exacerbated by the warming of the global climate. So the climate wasn't this warm during the last mega droughts back around 12 and 1300. So the buffer remains. The groundwater is a buffer. I'm making an effort to make sure that they recognize the ecological value of the buffer. And if not balance that with the economic buffer, well, to try to balance it with that rather than just to focus on the economic buffer, because if we drain the groundwater down too far, then that's going to drain our creeks. It's going to pull the water down too low for valley oaks and other native vegetation to reach. And that would be a disaster for the soils and for the air quality and for the quality of life that we all enjoy and have enjoyed, that humans have enjoyed here in the Central Valley for thousands of years.
Yeah, I have noticed, you know, just Chico Creek as it flows through town and after the 1 mile recreation pool, the creek tends to go dry through the university and along Bidwell Avenue and on its way out to the Sacramento River, but then all of a sudden there's water in it again just before it hits the Sacramento River. And I always wondered why that would go dry like that, even though the 1 mile pool was just full of water all the time. So could you explain how that happens?
Downstream from the university, it's leaking into the ground. And I haven't been there yet this spring, but I know the past summers it goes dry. And I'm anticipating it will go dry earlier this year. I haven't been there this year. It may already have some dry stretches in Big Chico Creek, which is too bad because there are fish up-migrating spring-run salmon that have returned to Butte Creek in numbers that we haven't seen for many decades. And I would anticipate that some fish would be coming up into Big Chico Creek as they did last year. But they can't get up if the creek goes dry in those stretches between the university and the river. And, of course, once Big Chico Creek gets towards the river, the water table's higher because the river's flowing through there.
Yeah, so that's that connection you're talking about, how the pressure in the groundwater kept creeks flowing during drought years, because that pressure would push water up into the creek bed.
That's right.
Now, because the pressure is down in the groundwater and the groundwater table is lower, the creeks actually tend to go dry or disappear down into that groundwater.
As it seeps into the dewatered aquifer, exactly so. And that happens not just in Big Chico Creek, but in creeks that people these days don't even think of as creeks that flow year-round. They think of them as ephemeral creeks or seasonal creeks. That would be like Little Chico Creek, Pine Creek, Mud Creek, Rock Creek, all these creeks that are in this northern part of Butte County. But these creeks used to be perennial creeks. They used to have water in them year-round. I'm friends with a gentleman whose family farmed here in Butte County for generations, and he's in his 80s now. But when he was a kid, he could swim in a swimming pool, in a pool in Rock Creek that went through their farming property year-round. They had a swimming hole, and they found a midden from a tribal midden where they would pile up materials from food processing, and they found piles of freshwater mussels, which also is an indicator of a perennial stream. Freshwater mussels can't survive in a seasonal stream. So it's clear from the evidence and clear from actual anecdotal experience that these creeks used to flow year-round and no longer do. And these creeks are, these small creeks are really important as rearing habitat. Back in the old days, they were even spawning habitat, but even more importantly, they provide a refuge for out-migrating salmon to come up and get away from the big fish that are in the main stem of the Sacramento River and take advantage of the larval insect life that lives in the creeks. And the fish that did make it up there, according to studies by Dr. Paul Maslin at Chico State University, the fish that made it up into Mud Creek, for instance, grew to a much larger extent than the ones that just stayed in the river because they had a refuge and they had more food to eat.
Yeah, so there is a direct connection between groundwater and the actual health of our creeks and rivers and all the wildlife and salmon, other fish there.
There is indeed, and the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, it's the acronym for it is SGMA, S-G-M-A, SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, has stipulations in there to protect groundwater-dependent ecosystems. And as the environmental representative on the Vina Subbasin Stakeholder Advisory Group, I am lobbying hard to protect these groundwater-dependent ecosystems. And one of the ones that's being neglected is the valley oak trees that are not right next to the creek. They have the ones designated near the creek as riparian forests, and they're saying these are groundwater-dependent. But I've presented evidence that the valley oak trees that are even located miles away from streams are tapping groundwater. According to the Forest Service, their roots can go down as far as 70 or 80 feet, and they need access with those deepest roots to the water table. And they pull the water up through the deep root into the shallower roots and then distribute it through the mycorrhizal system to the other ecosystem that surrounds these deep-rooted valley oak trees. So valley oak trees that are upland are also groundwater dependent. As part of SGMA, another stipulation, or a recommendation actually, it's not actually required, is to have coordination between adjacent groundwater management areas. So the Vina area is in northern Butte County. The Butte Groundwater Agency is in southern Butte County and kind of slops over into Colusa County. And then the Colusa Subbasin and the Corning Subbasin are also very close to the subbasin that I'm working in. And they all share the same aquifer. We're all sharing a single basin. So these are political boundaries in these groundwater subbasins. And they need to coordinate between them. And so Butte County is the head of a coordination group, and the Butte County supervisors are getting an update on it on the 27th. This will probably be broadcast a bit after that. But I've got a testimony for the supervisor meeting, which is going to happen tomorrow, that talks about what things we need to consider in interbasin coordination. And topmost, we need to have some very clear communication between the different water exploiters from the different groundwater sustainability areas.
So basically everyone that has a well punched into the Tuscan aquifer or the, you know, this water basin has a straw in the same drink.
To some extent, but most of the domestic wells are relatively shallow. Most of the domestic wells are 200 foot or less. So they're tapping the alluvial non-pressurized aquifer that is supported by the deep aquifer. If the deep aquifer is drained and depressurized to a greater extent, then these shallow aquifers will leak into it. So the health of domestic wells and shallow wells is a good indicator of how the groundwater is being managed. The big wells that are being developed by agricultural interests and by water purveyors like California Water Service are tapping the deepest portion of the aquifer. The Cal Water wells are 700 to 900 feet deep. The Glen Cluse irrigation well, located in Hamilton City in the Tuscan aquifer, is one of the deepest wells. It's down at about 1,100 feet. And these large diameter wells can pump as much as 5,000 gallons a minute out of the ground. And when they crank those things up, the impacts are not immediate. There's a time lapse and how it affects areas around it. The longer that time lapse takes to occur, the longer it takes for that area to recover. And the further away from those wells it is, the harder it is to actually associate that pumping with impacts that are located distant from it. But the cumulative effect of all these wells is pulling down the aquifer layer throughout the northern Sacramento Valley, which is a concern and something that this interbasin coordination needs to really consider.
So who has well rights, or, you know, the right to punch a hole into even the shallow aquifer or the deeper pressurized aquifer?
In basins that have not gone through legal adjudication that divvies up the groundwater rights, any overlying landowner has a right to pump groundwater from underneath their land surface if they put it to beneficial use. So even irrigation districts that have historically just pulled water out of the river to grow rice primarily, even these irrigation districts can punch wells into the ground, or the individual farmers can, and use it for supplemental water supply. And one of the strategies that's being used with this conjunctive use of the ground and the surface water is to sell the surface water allocation for the year. Now, keep in mind, they don't sell the surface rights because that's replenished every year. They can pull a certain amount out of the river every year, and they hold on to those rights because it's gold. But they'll sell a certain portion of the allocation, and then they'll continue to grow the crop by pumping groundwater. This is called conjunctive use of the water system. And this poses great risks to the non-participating users, but it provides great economic benefit to the people that can engage in it. Some of the people that are doing that are coordinating with the National Fisheries. This time of year, especially in a year like this, with so little water stored up in the main reservoirs at Oroville and Shasta reservoirs, they have to maintain a cold water pool that's down deep in the reservoirs. And in order to maintain that, sometimes these water districts will forego their early water up, their early deliveries to water up the rice fields, and they'll pump groundwater instead. And then later on, once they can release the cold water to keep the fish that are more or less stranded to have to do their reproductive cycle in the main stems of the river, a very unnatural thing because they used to be able to get up into the high waters of the McLeod River, the Pitt River, Butte Creek, Big Chico Creek, and get up high where the water was cold. The spring and winter salmon would go up there in the spring and winter, and they would hold all summer long in these pools that the water is cool from being spring-fed. But with the dams on most of the main stems, these fish now have to spawn in the main stems of the river. So they hold up near Red Bluff and Redding, and they hold down at the bottom of the dam, at Oroville as well. And so these water agencies are supposed to keep the water above 56 degrees, which is the uppermost limit where these fish eggs and the young fish can survive. They really should be trying to keep that water 50 degrees or less so that they have a greater temperature buffer. Because what happens and what probably is going to happen this year and what happened in 2015 is they ran out of the cold water pool and the water heated up to 60 degrees or warmer and it killed 95 to 100% of the fish. And we're anticipating this year that there's going to be a die-off of at least 75%, if not 100% of the fish once again. And if we get another dry year, that'll replicate the same problem. And if you get too many years in a row, you're going to literally wipe out these spring and winter salmon species because they have a return cycle of 2 to 4 years. And if you have too many consecutive years where they're reproductive failure, you're going to really wipe out that genetic pool. So that would be a disaster.
Could you explain one more time what SGMA is and maybe talk just a minute about the move toward groundwater recharge that some of these water districts are trying to do?
SGMA is a Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Groundwater recharge has legal risks associated with the privatization of the aquifer because it costs a lot of money to set up recharge basins and recharge facilities. Although the natural flooding of the landscape, as used to happen before the levees were built, was one of the ways the groundwater was recharged. So groundwater recharge is probably a viable strategy, but we need to really get through the legal issues first before the aquifer is privatized and then operated industrially. In the interbasin coordination, one of the things I'm suggesting is a region-wide moratorium on developing new large diameter wells, as well as a census of the existing large diameter wells that have screens at various levels that allow for the downward leakage of the shallow aquifer when the lower aquifer is dewatered and depressurized. This is what's happened in the San Joaquin Valley, and I'm very afraid that's what's going to happen up here. So again, I'm hoping for a moratorium on large diameter wells and a census and a possibly even a reconstruction of large diameter wells that are screened at multiple layers that allow the drainage of the shallow aquifers into the lower aquifer.
So I've been talking with Jim Brobeck, water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance, for our monthly installment of the North State Water Report. Jim, is there anything that our listeners can do to learn more about groundwater and SGMA and what they might be able to do to help support Aqua Alliance and your efforts and advocates?
Well, check out the aqualliance.net website, Aqua Alliance, with just one A in the middle. It's one word. And we've got blog entries, we've got videos, we've got radio interviews, we've got a donate button. We engage in planning, but we also engage in litigation when necessary to try to slow down the unwise exploitation of water resources that's going to crash the system if we don't slow down.
Thanks again, Jim, for another very informative North State Water Report.
Thank you, Ron Topi.
No, thank you both. Thank you both, Jim Brobeck, AquaAlliance.net, Ron Topi, RunForSalmon.org, for their second installment of the outstanding North State Water Report. Pleased to announce that you'll be able to look for the North State Water Report 5th Thursdays at 6 p.m. on KZFR 90.1 FM starting in July. And we're going out. We're going out with Zeke Lunder, Creekside, singing the first lines of Wild Chinook Salmon by Alice D. Macell, followed by the beginning of a live performance of the song from 2012. Good night, everyone, and never stop imagining community.
I'm a wild Chinook salmon, ain't no hatchery child. I'm a wild Chinook salmon, ain't no hatchery child. And when you dam up my rivers, you really cramp my style.